very much. It's really lovely to be here.
Back down in Cork.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks.
Rab.
Rab. Rab. Metamorphosis. The words are turning in on themselves and then turning into something else. They are turning over and under like birds dipping in water, turning the reflection of trees into rings and ripples in the lake. They are asleep and then they wake in the whiteness of the page. Black licked words fall like leaves, littering the reflection of the day. Then are released birds. So yeah, it's great to be here, but great to be back in Cork, and this is the new book, The Art of Dying. So I'm just going to read some poems from here, and the next poem is called The Girl with a Bag in Barcelona. What was in the bag of the girl who had just arrived in Barcelona? She sat down on a bench and unfolded a piece of paper that contained the address of her final destination. At the moment of her taking out a cigarette and assisting a passerby with a light, another man leaned over and placed his hand on her bag, taking it away so simply I assumed he was a friend playing a joke, until he broke into a bolt and the passerby turned cold as he ran after his accomplice, flicking the cigarette over his shoulder that sparked a trail before going out. By the time I'd shot up and shouted, "Thieves!" they were halfway across Plaza de Catalunya, disappearing among the throng on the Rambla. The girl didn't move and went on smoking like nothing had happened, as if she didn't care, taking long draws on her cigarette. Perhaps there was nothing of value in the bag, a magazine, toothbrush, tampons, dirty underwear. On the other hand, perhaps her stillness was a sign that there were items of overwhelming cost, legal documents, her great-grandmother's watch, a diamond ring, a signed copy of Ulysses, first edition. "Should I call the police?" I asked, sitting back down. She gave a shrug that showed the futility of my question. She seemed to have complete self-control. I thought she might be a pupil of the mysterious Tibetan school who acquire material possessions only so they can let them go, to learn the art of dying, slipping away quietly between thoughts when no one is looking. The thieves by now had been swallowed into the underbelly of Barry Gothique, prizing open their booty like ravens scrapping over roadkill. The bag, the cigarette, the moment snatched like a loose thought tossed to one side, while high above the muddy streets, behind the velvet curtained sky, a satellite spun out of orbit. So that was kind of the title poem, and a lot of the poems in this metamorphosis and funnily enough, birds sort of fly in and out of almost every poem in the book. But there's also the sense of sort of, with dying, of one thing passing and then another thing arising out of that. And a lot of them are sort of those, the gaps in between those moments of something passing and then something arising. But this is called The World, this poem, and it's about OCD. And of course, one of the defining features with OCD is ritual, and in myth as well, of course, ritual is sort of myth in action. But there's another way of coming at this poem. The other perspective is a child's perspective, and there's a sort of sense of a prenatal or postnatal memory going on. Anyway, we don't need to worry about that. This is called The World. My mother's kitchen was a sea of blue cupboards and shiny surfaces. The door was always closed or just ajar. Sometimes I'd peep in and spot her dusting packets on shelves or mopping the floor, smooth as an ice rink. A pot of wilting thyme sat dying of thirst on the windowsill, while outside a bare hedge ringed our home, fortifying us from next door. When I asked for water, she'd startle out of her cleaning waltz, spin on the spot, then take a polished glass from the highest cupboard and dash to the taps. I'd catch her twisted image bending in its chrome arm, letting the gush of water run cold before filling the glass. I'd stand at the door, wanting to break through its icy exterior, the sea of glass, but knew if I did, the world would shatter. And this is called 1601. The light of a star that exploded 400 years ago becomes visible to the naked eye. A prince treads the boards. This bodes some strange eruption to our state. The ghost of his father appears ashen-faced. Just after four, the second Earl of Essex is executed for treason. Across the Irish Sea, men march down to Cork from Donegal. Blasts from hell. Crops fail worldwide due to a volcano in Peru. The Spanish Armada lies shipwrecked off the Irish coast. The final stone is placed on the cairn of Gaelic rule. Earls take flight for Europe, thwarted desire, a bloody end. Famine sweeps through Russia. The prince finds himself in a black hole. There's a special providence in the fall of a sparrow. And this is one of those bird poems, and it's called Anatidiphobia, and the meaning of it is explained rather quickly within the poem. Anatidiphobia is the fear that somewhere in the world there is a duck watching you. No matter where you are, a ringed teal stares down its long bill, searing your skin. You may be on the lavatory 12,000 feet above sea level, and yet you turn cold as the leer of a mallard stares up through the bowl. The trauma often goes back to a time in childhood when the victim was scared or injured by a duck. Perhaps they were flapped at in a park, then tripped and scuffed their knees. But anatidiphobia can sneak up on you out of nowhere. It can appear like the seasonal migration of hooper swans to the lakes. Anatidiphobia is irrational. It is a creature with wings that cuts through everything. It is the all-seeing eye of a jealous duck. There is no duck in the sky, and yet people will kill to tell you there is a duck. While the condition is rare, it is possible that somebody, somewhere, will develop it now. There are various evolving suppositions across a wide spectrum of science and medicine on anatidiphobia. Many of them appear to be peddled by quacks. Nevertheless, propounding theories on quantum mechanics make it even more probable that there is a duck looking at you. There is a duck. There is always a duck. It is a creature with wings that sees through everything. It is what soaks you when you wake in the middle of the night. Some people let it fall off them, others drown. And she says, well, this collection is dedicated to my partner's kids, and it's kind of four children, and there's we were talking about music. Matthew and Graham and I were talking about Bob Dylan and Radiohead and other artists, and there's a quote from Radiohead where he says at the end of one of his songs, this one is for the children. But of course Radiohead say it with a lot of irony, because this song is very much about global warming, and that's taken on a whole new relevance in the recent days that have gone by. But this is a poem, a cool poem, and it has nothing to do with Radiohead. but it's for a Cork actor called Kieron Birmingham, who played... in fact, this was written, first of all, as a poem, and then it was upcycled into a monologue, into a play called Life Death, where Kieron, who's a very fine Cork actor, he's been in lots of things, including Games of Thrones and all sorts of stuff.
He's a Dane in the pantomime this year.
Oh, yeah, he's in the pantomime.
Okay. Everyman. Red Riding Hood.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So he's in the Everyman pantomime. So yeah, that's it. Anyway, this is called... So this is one of those things you write and it gets turned into something else and then it went back into a poem, and it's called Poem. I found a perfectly polished pebble the size of a tennis ball, washed up by the morning tide. I took it home and put it on my table, a paperweight for words that might otherwise take wing with the gulls beyond the window. With time, I noticed it appeared to be growing until it was too big for the table. So I placed it by the door as a doorstop. It kept growing, pushing me aside. One morning, I came downstairs and noticed a hairline crack running across it. It started to shake, and a little beak peeped through. And this collection, there's three sections to it, and the second section is called the Talking Tree Alphabet. And it's inspired from the Celtic tree alphabet, the Oum, and the old Irish language where each letter, each tree is connected to a letter in the old Irish language, so the title of each poem is a different tree. So I'll just read one of those poems. I'll read this one. This is most of the myths in it are quite hidden, but this is probably the most most obvious one. Rowan. For her heart, the princess asked Finbar to fetch a branch of rowan berries blooming on the other side of the river, guarded by the one-eyed ogre. Her devoted lover swam across to the forbidden enclosure where berries blinked ruby necklaces, small dancing flames on black-tipped wicks. The ogre came thumping towards him, wielding a knuckled cudgel, took one swing, flapping the air, missed and toppled down with a whump on his back. Finbar, never taking his eye off the prize, climbed on the ogre's belly and bounced and jounced and plucked the thickest branch of finest berries and brought them back to his princess. He fed her the bittersweet, intoxicating seeds, then, ringed within the blushing beads, they made love on the forest floor. Her feet took root in the earth. Inside her belly grew a tree of fire. Her arms gnarled and knotted into branches. Her hair flamed red, and she vanished within the dark bark. Finbar went to fetch an axe to try and cut his princess out, but when he returned, a dozen other roans had grown, and he wasn't sure which switch of the woods she was. The earth shook beneath him. A vast shadow swallowed the sun. I'm not terribly clever at really explaining my poems. especially when it's a new book, because you're very close to them, and it's something I'm a bit skeptical of as well, because I wonder if poets should be sort of experts on what they're writing about. But I did write a poem about that very problem, and it's called Would You Like Me to Read You a Poem? Would you like me to read you a poem? Very well, I thought I'd choose this one. It's a little long, but I think it somewhat explores the avian symbolism discussed earlier. The first line's non sequitur never fails to hook readers in. In fact, the entire opening on unrequited love is to die for, so to speak. There's a bit of an opaque image after that we won't go into here. Suffice to say, the speaker is referring to his, her mother and or sister, perhaps. Lest we forget, it was after this middle period that the poet relapsed into brutal silence. The second section is an allusion to a song Aunt Vivian used to sing, the exact words of which escape me. But its indefatigable pursuit of the sublime and meditations on time are unparalleled, the language being at once astringent and ravishing, complete like a nucleus, an organism, or orgasm, you might say. Yet it's the final anti-heroic couplet that comes across as the most accomplished. The unshrinking S&M safe word sequence reaches new dizzying heights. The subtle measure inevitably comes together and mirrors the matter, spawning a groundswell of vowels that work with and against the flights of fancy. Perhaps more striking than anything is its ability to whip off the gauntlet while at the same time refuse to give itself away entirely. Its determination not to lie down and be buggered, to coin a phrase. Not to mention the bare-cheeked audacity of the denouement that lies at its centre, at its golden centre, like a scantily clad Mediterranean girl, turning away, unknowingly exposing the penumbra of her behind, which in the end is perhaps its most enduring trait. I should point out, some critics consider its tone naive and whimsical and indicate that the syncopated rhythm of shifting accents reflects the theme of arrested development and so on, etc. But I'll leave that for you to determine. Anyway, if you're quite ready, I'll begin. Following from that, three more poems. Which poem is it? Oh yeah, this is called Operation Cleansing 11, and Cleansing 11 refers to the religious practice of eliminating all traces of bread or flour from people's homes on the eve of Passover. And Operation Cleansing 11 was the name given to the 1948 campaign which saw 1 million Palestinians killed or displaced. And it comes with a quote from Harold Pinter, who said, "The desperate plight of the Palestinian people, the central factor of world unrest." And it always struck me that he used world unrest, not Middle East unrest, but world unrest. Pinter was, of course, an amazing writer and poet, but also an amazing political activist. And I wonder what he'd be saying now. Observers spend the weeks in a flurry of house cleaning to expunge every scrap from all parts of the home. Flour is treated as vermin and must be quashed at all costs. Law requires the elimination of olive-sized or larger quantities of leavening, but a good housekeeper leaves no seed unturned. The cracks of kitchen counters are thoroughly scrubbed to remove any traces, however small. Then, when every last molecule has been disposed of, observers wash their hands and every part of their person to avoid any suggestion of contamination. And this one's called Angry Birds, and it's after the game Angry Birds, but it's also there's also an allusion to the parable of the prodigal son, of the son who's kind of lost, sent away, and then is found again, taken into the fold. And that's also one of the themes in this collection. There's lots of archetypal themes between mother, father, and then the sort of the journey that goes on. There, Angry Birds. I'm lost in this world of crazy kamikazes, selflessly flinging their harlequin bodies against timber planks, panes of glass, and metal bars to snuff out a spread of swine. Wasted with flu, the only thing I can do is play a game on my phone, the single premise of which is to catapult birds against a litter of pigs hidden in various structures. Struck down with a fever over 100, health feels like a childhood that can't be recaptured. Poorly as the prodigal son who squandered everything. I can create chaos with a stroke of my finger, send raptors to collapse complex constructions, pickaxing and squawking into scaffolding. Shot starlings explode into formations, tumbling down on a battalion of pug-nosed snorters who keep growing and dying with every level of delirium. I can only dream that these feathered friends hold some answer, that they are my deliverers, carrying me home, wherever that may be. I should say, I stole that last line from Elizabeth Bishop. Okay, well, I'm out for time. We're out for time?
Yeah, you're
up. Okay, I'll read two more poems. And I've just finished with two poems from the Talking Tree alphabet, and this one is called Oak. Thanks very much for listening. A very attentive audience. Nerve-wracking, you say. Oak. The old oak is our father, coming home late at night, turning his key in the door, leaving it off the latch. The leaves are still falling. I hear his slippered footsteps shuffle on the stairs, scuff along boards. He stifles a cough, opening my door, and releases the catch from the window, taking my breath as the curtains mushroom. A pattern of web branches frames the moon. His great shadow bows low and creaks down the years, pressing his whiskered cheeks to my brow, whispering good night. The old oak swishes and moans. Low mutterings meander through the house. The wind brushes my face, the sound of leaves patting the pane. The moon is in the wind, and the wind is in the bough, and the bough is in the door that our father leaves open. And this last poem is called Pine. And again, thanks very much for listening. Thank you, Paul. Thanks, Rap was gone. Thanks very much. Cheers, Rap. Pine. We drove through dusk up the mountain pass, pushing through villages without stopping. The promise of a last petrol station never arrived. The gauge flashed red. The clutch kept slipping. Darkness fell, rubbing its thick musk against the windscreen, dragging its black tail over us. The husks of old tyres, piled high like totems on the side of the road, seemed to mark the end of a civilization. We were ascending towards the next century. The dust from the lowlands scattered behind us. The car started to steam and chug like a sick animal. None of us spoke, willing ourselves forward, our heads getting lighter, the air turning sweeter with pine. When we reached the peak, I put her into neutral and we rolled with the windows down. The sound of tyres tearing over tarmac, the wind whistling in our ears. Then, out of the blackness, a cluster of lights appeared, as if the heavens were below us. Thank you very much.